Welcome to Writers on Writing. I'm your host, Barbara DeMarco Barrett. We broadcast from the University of California Irvine campus and at 88.9 KUCI FM. We stream live at kuci.org. Today, my guest is Scott Spencer. Scott is perhaps best known for his novel, Endless Love, that sold more than 2 million copies and was a finalist for the National Book Award, as was his 2003 novel, A Ship Made of Paper. Other novels include Waking the Dead, Willing, The Rich Man's Table, and Men in Black, which is no relation to the movie franchise. He's here today to talk about his new novel, An Ocean Without a Shore, published by Echo. Welcome back to the show, Scott.
Hi, Barbara. Great to hear your voice.
Yeah, great to have you. Let's begin, as we always do, with you introducing the book and talking about how it came about.
Well, this book came about differently from any novel I've written before, because the characters and some of the basic situations were all set up in the book that I had written right before this one, which is called A River Under the Road. And though this book doesn't really depend on the reader having read that first book, I have obviously read that first book, and I used these characters again and just continued their story. When I first started River Under the Road, I thought it would just be one book, but I realized that the things that I wanted to think about and describe and dramatize were so various and moved through time for such an extensive period that the book would end up about 800 pages. And I didn't want to write an 800 page book because I don't even like to pick up 800 books. So I stopped River Under the Road at a certain point and then came back to it. But I wanted to, I'd sort of written myself out in the vein that River Under the Road was written in, and I wanted to take a different approach. River Under the Road was written in the close third person, and I wanted to write in the first person, which is what I really enjoy doing the most anyhow. And I chose a secondary character from River Under the Road, whose name is Kip, to be the narrator of this book. What I wasn't prepared for was that Kip's voice would be extremely arresting to me, and his story became very arresting to me, that he sort of ran away with the book. I had first conceived of him as a kind of Nick Carraway type who would talk about Gatsby, but who many readers would not really think about that much after the end of the book, but it didn't turn out that way for me. Kip ran away with the book completely.
I'm trying to remember him from A River Under the Road, because I did read that book, and I'm trying to remember what part he played in that.
I don't know what that was, but that was strange. I just heard music. Kip was his college friend. He edited the literary magazine in that first book. And when Thaddeus and Grace get married in River Under the Road, it's at Kip's loft.
Okay.
And actually they go to something that's sort of like Plato's retreat.
So in An Ocean Without a Shore, Kip is tormented by his unrequited love for Thaddeus. Can you talk about kind of giving form to him in this book?
I'm sorry. Barbara, we have to stop for a second. I'm getting all kinds of music coming into my earphones. You're not.
So the narrator, Kip, I'm trying to remember him from A River Under the Road. What part did he play there? Remind me.
He did a couple of things in River Under the Road. He was always, Thaddeus's college friend. And when Thaddeus gets married to Grace, They do it in Kip's loft, and Kip pays for the wedding, actually, and hires caterers. And then later on in River Under the Road, they go to what is basically Plato's retreat with Kip, and there's a kind of a weird Plato's retreat kind of scene. But he's not really that central to the action. He's looking on at this family. I've always been interested in looking on in other people's families, of wanting to be in someone else's family. And Kip is constantly observing Thaddeus's home life, partly because he doesn't really have a home life of his own, and partly, or mainly, because he's been in love with Thaddeus since they first met way back when in Ann Arbor, Michigan, when they were both going to the University of Michigan.
Yeah, because he is quite tormented by unrequited love, his love for Thaddeus. And you know, while he might have liaisons with others during the course of the book, no one ever kind of steals his heart as Thaddeus does. And yet, you know, Thaddeus is married. He, you know, really has no interest in that aspect of his relationship with Kip.
That's true. He's married. He has two children. He has all kinds of other concerns. I mean, he really likes Kip, and he's a good friend to Kip, it seems. But, you know, there may be a bit of duplicity in it because he also needs Kip. And, you know, it remains a mystery, both to Kip and to the reader, how much does Thaddeus know about the depths of Kip's feelings toward him? Because Kip will never speak of it.
Yeah. Well, you know, speaking of unrequited love, I have read most of your books, and it seems to me that unrequited love is a theme in many of them. Is that something you're aware of, or do you even think about theme when you're writing, or after your book, do you let readers decide what the themes are?
Yes, well, yes, I don't really think about themes when I'm writing. I think about the characters, I think about the story, I think about the language. And sometimes there's a kind of willful blindness as you go forward. I think if you knew everything about what you were doing and why you were doing it, it would be actually even more difficult to do it. I mean, it's difficult enough. There's a kind of dogged pursuit of something that at least I experience when I'm writing. I'm just on the trail sniffing and running and trying to capture something. And so grand sort of sweeping things about the thematic nature of the story, I could think about later. I mostly think about it when somebody points it out to me. I mean, even you're pointing out that I've written often about unrequited love is interesting to me, because I don't think of it that way. I think of the relationship between my novels as being more about form and style and language. And that's, you know, I'm developing in that way. But yeah, you're probably right. I mean, you know, it's sort of a standard trope of storytelling that the character should want something that the character doesn't have.
So going into An Ocean Without a Shore, were you focused on that then with Kip? What does he want? What doesn't he have? How can he get what he wants? Or how can he, you know, what sort of obstacles can be put in his way? Do you think that way?
Well, I do, not, again, not globally, but step by step. I mean, mm-hmm. I knew that Kip wanted to be with Thaddeus. And then that's big enough in a way to get started. But from that initial core of desire, there comes all kinds of other interesting aspects of his character. I mean, why would Kip fixate on a married man with two children? does Kip choose somebody who is, for all intents and purposes, unavailable because he wants to remain in the closet? Does he do this as a kind of self-punishment? Does he sense something in Thaddeus that maybe Thaddeus doesn't sense in himself? What is the function of our desire? And what is the function of our frustrated desire? I mean, one of the things that interested me in this novel is how our biographies can be looked at as, you know, the things that we did, but our biographies are also the things that we didn't do. And our biographies are also the things that we didn't say. I mean, at one point I say in the novel that that silence shapes us like a lathe and gives us our final form. And that remained a really fascinating idea to me as I went forward in the novel, to what extent has silence made Kip the man he is, who is, I think, a very appealing and compassionate and cultured and smart guy. But who would he have been if he had broken that silence?
You know, that connects with something else I wanted to ask you about, again, with theme, because one of the themes of the book for me was identity and how to live as you truly are and if that's possible. And Kip has a revelation that he will never be known for who he truly is. That was something else that seemed to be all over the book.
I think you're right. And, you know, it's interesting to write about a character whose sense of personal privacy is so great that he remains in the closet, because I set this novel way after Stonewall, way after the first and the second and even the third wave of gay liberation. Yet he is essentially untouched by it. He's aware of it. He longs for it. You know, he gives money to AIDS causes, but he will not declare himself. So what kind of man is that? Is he the only person left in America who is embarrassed or ashamed or private or secretive and won't say what he wants or who he is? I came to believe that no, he's not. That even as the circle of freedom enlarges, there are still people who are secretive about their sexuality, about their politics, about their past, about their desires. And I sort of wrote this book and thinking about the things in my life that I've kept secret. And I think that there's a whole universe of silence out there that coexists with the universe of endless self-expression.
So true. That's so true. Well, Thaddeus, again, Kip has been obsessed with him forever, it seems. Thaddeus is a writer, and you have a lot of novels with writers as major characters. And I don't know who said it. Someone I listened to or talked to said, oh, never make your characters writers because, it's not really interesting to readers. And I find it, of course, totally interesting and love that you have writers as characters. Why do you think they become writers? Why are they writers?
Well, first of all, let's talk about this person who said that. That's ridiculous. I'm sorry. I mean, that's like saying you shouldn't write in the first person, which some great writing teachers have said. There really are no rules about what you can and can't do in writing a novel. It's what makes the novel so fantastic and what makes it so difficult. We're given a great deal of freedom and a great many opportunities to blow it. But we're also given a great many opportunities to do something really interesting and sometimes even very new. And to say that a main character of a novel can't be a writer or shouldn't be a writer and that readers aren't interested in that, that I don't think that the history of literature bears that out whatsoever. I like to have characters who are writers because, first of all, I know a lot of writers and and I use little tiny aspects of myself in creating character. But it's also, I like characters who are alive to language, and writers are. So I think to have the story go through somebody who's not only aware of where the story is heading, but is also doing it with a sensitivity toward language is interesting and enriching.
Yeah, I mean, some of my favorite books have writers as protagonists, and I'm, you know, it's my favorite. But in terms of Thaddeus being a writer, he's a screenwriter. And I wondered, I mean, you know, you've had a lot of experience with film and with having your stuff made into film. And how much of that have you given to Thaddeus? How much of that experience?
Well, Thaddeus is a failed writer in many ways, because what Thaddeus wanted to do, I mean, Thaddeus wanted my job, but he just couldn't get it. Thaddeus wanted to write novels, he wanted to write stories, and he got frustrated because he wasn't getting the reaction to them that he had hoped for. And so in a fit of frustration and also really needing something to happen because he was rather poor, he wrote a script that through some kind of lucky coincidence really clicked. He wrote a script about a fictitious Arab country when Islamic students take over a US embassy, and it just coincides with the Iranian students taking over the US embassy in Tehran. So suddenly there's a bidding war going on for his script, and he becomes relatively he's got a lot of money, and he buys this house, and that success leads to other work, but it all kind of fades away, and suddenly he's a kind of washed up screenwriter owning a house that he can no longer afford, but which he holds on to as the kind of living symbol that once he was a successful guy. Now, none of that happened to me. So but little things that I observed when I worked in California are in the book, and certain types of people that I observed when I worked in the movie business are in that book. But I never had a bidding war or bought a big riverside estate that I couldn't afford, alas.
And yet, Endless Love was pretty successful.
Yes, I mean, it was.
It was kind of great. The novel, as I recall, it's been a while since I read it, but the novel seemed to be different from the movie. I suppose that happens all the time.
Yes, the novel was sort of dark and lush, and the movie, well, there were actually two movies made of it. Shortly after the novel came out, the director Franco Zeffirelli was hired to turn it into a movie, and he didn't really connect that strongly to the book, and he made a pretty bad movie that got trounced, and then, I don't know, what, 20 years later, something like that, somebody else made a movie of it. This time, with the first time when Franco Zeffirelli made a movie, they were courteous to me. I was invited to the set, and I got to meet Brooke Shields and Elizabeth Taylor, and all kinds of people. The second time they made the movie, they didn't even tell me. I didn't even know that it was in production until a journalist called me up to get my reaction. Like, how do you feel about Universal remaking your novel? And I said, wow, I don't feel that good about it. So that was not a great experience. I had another, my novel, Waking the Dead, was made into a movie, and that was sort of lovingly made by Keith Gordon, with Jodie Foster producing it, and Billy Crudup and Jennifer Connelly in it. And that was a nice movie and a pleasant experience.
Did you like it? Did you like the movie itself?
I did. You know, I thought it's really hard, at least for me, to let go of what I did and see it in a different way. And I said, no, I didn't mean that. No, what about this? But I also thought that they were, in some ways, almost too respectful of the novel. But that said, I thought it was a very, very nice movie with some really, really first-rate acting in it.
There are writers who refuse to let their books be made into movies because, ruining them.
Yeah.
And there's that James Cain quote that I cannot remember exactly, that he's like...
I can.
Okay.
I just said it in conversation. It's so funny. When some journalist asked him, what do you think of what Hollywood did to your novels? And he pointed to his bookshelf and he said, My novels are right over there. I couldn't do anything to them.
Yeah. Yeah. I would think that the financial, side of it could be a good thing for a writer, allow you to keep writing and do what you do best and what you love best.
You're right, Barbara. It's the financial thing, because writing a book takes a long time for most people. It usually takes me between 2 and 5 years. And you're not getting paid that much. And if you think of it, as a monthly salary, it's not very much at all. So selling a book to the movies gives you a lot more time than you would have had to write and not worry about making mortgage payments or anything like that. And it's also, most people, myself included, love the movies. Yeah. So the curiosity of seeing it and wondering how they would interpret it, and what an actor would say, and how an actor would say these lines, and what the landscape would look like, and what the music would be like, the lure of that is pretty great and hard to resist. Although I hear what you say, and that there are writers who refuse to do that. I haven't met any of those, but I'm sure they're out there.
You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Scott Spencer. We're talking about An Ocean Without a Shore, published by Echo, his new novel. I want to talk about the beginning of the book, and or maybe have you read first, and then I can ask you what I am thinking to ask you. Would you read from the book?
Sure, let me get it out here. Okay, here we are. Chapter 1, Mornings Were Difficult. Let me interrupt myself by saying every chapter has a title, which I've never done before, and I think I'm always going to do that now. I just love doing that. Chapter 1, Mornings Were Difficult. My name is Christopher Woods, but just about everyone calls me Kip. Soon, I'm going to be finding out what the judge has decided to give me, though it's really what will be taken away, such as the right to sleep in my own bed, retire and rise on my own schedule, go to the movies, take walks, drink wine, and just about every other of life's pleasures heretofore taken for granted. It would have been less stressful if sentencing had come immediately on the heels of the verdict, but it might be a good sign that it wasn't. Despite the encouraging words of counsel, I knew from the start that a not guilty verdict was a pipe dream. And while the lawyers continue to be insistently, almost insanely optimistic, it's quite likely there's a lot more than a slap on the wrist in store for me. I recently read a report written by an Israeli novelist about his 6 months in a coma following a head injury in the Six Days War, a dreamy, often phantasmagoric record of the visions he had while hovering between life and death. I'm certainly not comatose. Instead of visions, I'm beset with piercing and exact memories, but I do feel as if I'm hovering between two distinct states of being, my life in New York City and my impending incarceration. It must be said, however, that in the ways that matter most, I've been something of a prisoner my entire life. But being a prisoner in a cell of your own design and acting as your own warden and parole board is a considerable remove from a real penitentiary. And as I await my sentence, I decided my life took its first turn toward the present disaster on March 12th, 1997. I had been out late the night before with a woman named Lori Kaplan, whose father was a client at Adler Associates, the small investment firm where I worked. Lori was an actress, currently in a Sam Shepard play, though in real life she was sunny, endlessly optimistic. She was my date for an AIDS benefit held at the St. Regis Hotel, a dinner followed by an art auction. I spent $22,500 on a small Kiki Smith sculpture, after which the entire ballroom applauded, a sure sign I'd spent too much. I didn't mind. It was a nice piece and a good cause. I wasn't making huge amounts of money, but I gave regularly to that particular AIDS organization, tithing myself in accordance to the precepts of the only church to which I belonged, the church of not acting like a selfish jerk. I got Lori home to her sublet on Ludlow Street about midnight and was back in my place on Charles Street shortly after that, read for a while, and was asleep by 1:30, only to be awakened 4.5 hours later by a phone call. Mornings were difficult for me, increasingly so as I aged, running out of time and all of that, the rising sun, a blow to the heart. Another night has passed with kisses unkissed, confidences unspoken, and left to wane, wilt, wither, and die. You do your best to perk yourself up. You remind yourself that things could be a great deal worse. You're living well. You enjoy your own company. You're still holding at your college weight. Season's tickets to the Met. So many consolations. But sadness can be sneaky. And sometimes upon waking, you feel a certain degree of devastation. Wallflowers lament, unrequited love, etc., etc. You get used to it. It's like living through a war or waking up every morning horribly overweight, which I'm not, or waking up homely, which I am, sort of. However, on the morning this story begins, I didn't have time for my usual longing, and my rituals of unrequited love began to change, as if the 12 stations of the cross had been suddenly supplemented with a 13th.
Thank you so much. That was Scott Spencer reading from An Ocean Without a Shore, published by Echo. And what I wanted to ask you about was the beginning has a sort of feeling of a prologue. You know, there's something that is going to happen. He's going to, you know, go to jail for something. We don't know what at this point, and we don't find out for a while. And I was curious why you didn't make it a prologue, or you didn't write a prologue with that going on. Had you considered that, or do you hate prologues, or what? What was going on with that?
No, I don't hate prologues.
Well, some people do.
I'm not a hater, so. And if I do start hating, I'm not going to start with prologues. I didn't think of that. I think it'd all be the same to the reader. It's just, you know, just says something different at the. I think it just lands in the same way, and yeah, I don't know why I didn't do that. I do know why now that you give me a chance to think about it. Because at the end of that first chapter, it leads into a second chapter, which is the very next evening. So we're really at the beginning of the story. It's not like, to me, a prologue would be something that would happen considerably before the main act of the book. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, that's a good reason. That's plus definitely a good reason.
Plus, it never occurred to me.
Well, you know, it's sort of like, you know, what we talked about earlier, where, you know, certain agents or writers say, you know, never write about writers. And I also hear that, you know, the controversy about prologues, you know, that some people love them, some people hate them. If you can get by without writing one, don't do it. And, yeah. I don't know.
I don't think I've ever had I don't think I've ever used the P word in writing. Hmm. I don't think so. I have to think about that. I've written 12 books, so I could have in the past and now don't remember. But I'm going to step out on a limb and say I've never done that.
You know, I wanted to ask you what you said and about titles. You know, I know I was going to ask you about the chapter titles as well. And before you read, you said you never did this before, and you're always going to do this in the future. Why? Why is that?
Well, just really for my own pleasure. I don't know if it means that much to readers, and the people who've talked to me about the book have been kind of silent about the chapter titles, and I don't want to ask because I want to bring it up. But I really enjoy doing it, and it's sort of, you know, when I was a young reader, I loved those novels by Charles Dickens so much, and they always have chapter titles. George Eliot has chapter titles. It's something that is a kind of traditional novel thing. And I suppose in the larger scheme of the things, even though I don't think of myself as traditional as a person, my sense of the novel makes use of the novel's tradition and things that have always been sort of the cornerstones of novels, which was, you know, plot and character are always the things that draw me into writing, and actually draw me mostly into, for the most part, into reading. So I'm giving honor to that by titling my chapters. I mean, I don't want to be too global because I've only done it once and maybe I'll never do it again, but I really enjoyed doing it. The titles are important to me. And one of the things that was a little disorienting and even disquieting about publishing this book is that for the entirety of my working on it, it had a title that was not this title. And when I gave the book to my publisher, he said, I don't like that title. And we could never design a jacket around it because it's very, very long. It's like crazily long. I mean, the title I was using was The Things We Do to Keep the Truth from Coming Out. It's a good title for this book. It comes from a poem by Miller Williams, which is very beautiful. And but they were really adamant about it. And so I found myself with a finished novel that didn't have a title. And for me, the title is one of the first things that comes when I start a new book. And I need that title. It's sort of my destination. It's you know, it's my compass point. It's my true north. And then suddenly it was gone. And I really was nonplussed. So what I did was start paging through the manuscript, seeing if there was something there, something in a sentence or somewhere that could serve as a title or at least point me toward a title. And I came across An Ocean Without a Shore and felt relieved.
Yeah, it's a good one. It kind of encapsulates Kip, right?
Yes.
And his, exactly. You know, what he's going through, what he's been living.
I mean, the idea is that if your desire is unrequited, unacknowledged, that there's no real object to it, you're just alone with it. And what I did was I opened my book and just started scanning the pages, seeing if there was something there that could serve as a title or that could point me toward a title. And that's how I came up with An Ocean Without a Shore, because at a certain point, Kip says that, you know, when your desire is, when you have no means to express your desire and your longing, I think he says it's longing, it just goes on and on like an ocean without a shore.
Mm. Yeah,
you know,
that's good.
I subsequently learned that, I mean, there's a couple of other Ocean Without a Shore books. That there's any title you come up with, by the way, you're going to find another book or two that already has that title. It's completely horrifying. Mm-hmm. These weren't novels, and they seem to be something that, to deal with some issues in Muslim theology. Mm. There might be something in the Quran about that. I need to find out.
Well, I wanted to tell you about a chapter title that meant a lot to me, and it was chapter 16 that began with a title to a Delmore Schwartz collection of short stories, and Dreams Begin Responsibilities.
Right.
I loved that book. I read it in college, and when I saw that title, it also got me to thinking about all the authors that may not be read so much anymore, except maybe in MFA programs.
Yeah. I don't know. It's hard to know who survives. And I don't know if MFA programs are pointing their students toward Delmore Schwartz, but they should. They should, because especially in MFA programs, because, you know, most of the people in there are young and they're, to one extent or another, writing about their parents or thinking about their parents. And that's really a classic story in which the writer thinks of his parents before he was born. And what is it, as I recall, you probably recall better than I do, he basically is just shouting, don't do it.
Yeah.
Don't get together. It's going to be a disaster.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and it's moving me to want to read it again. Did you do that with any of the other titles? Did you use collection titles or titles from maybe stories we may not be familiar with anymore?
I think I use Howl as a title, which is, you know, obviously the title of a poem. And I use another song title that I love, which is Closing Time, which is a Leonard Cohen title.
Yes.
And I think that is it.
Hmm. I wanted to ask you about setting, because in the novel, you've returned to Leyden, New York.
I use Naked Lunch too. I forget. I just remembered.
Oh, what was that?
I use Naked Lunch as one of
those. Oh, yeah. Of course. Okay. But the setting, talk about why you've created a fictional town and returning to that fictional town with this book.
You know, these things in some ways just happen. And, you know, to be perfectly blunt about it, there's some extent it's for my own convenience that I don't have to make up a new place. But also it's because the town is not very different from where I live my daily life. And so I'm observing a lot and thinking of a lot as I go through my days here and meet people and know people and hear their stories that are obviously taking place here. So I've found it so far to be really fertile soil in which to, you know, run my little farm of stories. I mean, it's sort of perfectly situated. It's near enough New York, so we get that energy and we get enough of the people from New York here to mix things up. Yet it's connected to our endangered and somewhat disappearing natural world. And also, life is more visible here somehow, that people are less guarded and you can see their stories unfolding. That said, in the book I'm about to begin, doesn't take place in that town. And I'll probably come back to it at some future time if I have the time to do that. But I think that I've used Leyden, New York, 5 times in a row. Mm.
And why a new one? Why a new town? When will it be a fictional town?
The town, because the story I'm telling needs to take place in Chicago.
I see. So
no way around it.
Yeah. So as you're writing, I mean, at what point do you have an idea for a new novel? Do you wait till you're completely done and the current novel's in production? Or do ideas come to you as you're writing? And you go, you know what, I'm going to write this down. I'm going to come back to it. How does that work?
What normally has happened for me is that when I'm writing my novel, it's a little scary because, you know, you're not writing 24 hours a day, so you have time to think about other things. And when I think, I wonder what I'll do after this, I see nothing. It's just, there's nothing there. And I wonder, I said, wow, is this really, am I writing my final book? That's too bad. And then as I'm nearing the end of what I'm working on, other little shoots start coming up and I say, oh, there's going to be something after this. And it's actually my way of finding out or letting myself know that I've come to the end of the process of working on the book that I'm on, because it's not always totally easy to know because I do so many drafts. I mean, I don't think that I've ever written a book that had less than 5 drafts, and often there's twice that number. So there has to be some way of knowing, okay, I'm done. There's nothing more I can do. There's nothing more in my power, anyhow, to make this better. And the way that I have known that in the past is that I start thinking about something else.
I'm going to make a wild assumption, or maybe not so wild, and say that you entered publishing before there was such reliance on categorization of genres. Is this so?
Yes, you're absolutely right.
How do you feel about that? I mean, how do you feel about how, you know, it seems that, you know, if you query an agent about a novel now, you have to say where you think it belongs. It's commercial fiction, it's literary fiction, it's a rom-com, it's this, it's that. I mean, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I don't really know what to think about that. It seems unfortunate because there's a lot of books that are impossible to classify by genre, and unless you're going to say, you know, serious literary fiction is a genre, which I sort of think is silly. Anything really good would be impossible to put into a category. I mean, a book becomes its own category. Books are idiosyncratic. That's one of the things that we love about them. So I don't think that that's a healthy development.
Well, how's it been for you? I mean, we're in the middle of this pandemic, or who knows where we are in it, whether we're in the middle, toward the end, at the beginning. But I saw you a few weeks back. You did an event with Francine Prose, which was quite nice. And of course, we are doing this one via Zoom as well. And how has it been for you? I mean, what do you think? What do you think in terms of, you know, when we all come out of this, do you think these events will continue? Have they been good? Do you think we're reaching more readers because now we're not so reliant on people being in a town, in the city where events are going on? What do you think?
Well, I miss meeting people and you know, seeing new places. But that said, I think that this is probably a more sensible way of doing it. I mean, I think the publishers will hang on to it because they want us to be able to talk to people and listen to people and have our book get publicized, but it's expensive to send writers out on a plane and put them in a hotel and all the things that are involved in touring. And now here we are just sitting at our desks, not really spending a penny, and the publisher is has to like that. I mean, I think that there'll be certain big name writers who have huge, you know, like David Sedaris, who can pack 2,000 people to a place. You know, he's going to be able to do that, I hope, at some point. But for most books, I think that this is probably a good way to do it. I mean, I don't want to like become, I'm not pro-pandemic. I mean, this is a catastrophe in most ways. But I think that for writers, it's in as much as it affects our doing our job, it's not been as bad for us as it has been for a lot of people. I mean, I have friends who are actors. It's a total nightmare.
Yeah. Maybe we'll come out of this with some sort of hybrid, you know? I mean, because last night I attended something at the American Writers Museum in Chicago. I would never have gone to Chicago for this. And yet, you know, I learned how a writer
it?
I wasn't. It was great. It was Natasha Trethewey with her memoir, Memorial Drive. And it was just, you know, a wonderful interview between her and Donna Seaman. And I didn't even know about the American Writers Museum in Chicago. So, you know, it'd be nice if we come out of this with a hybrid of events, of live and online events.
I think you're right. I think that's what will happen. I think that's what will happen. But really, as somebody who's gotten on a plane and, you know, travel 500 miles to talk to 16 people. Then you feel that the whole thing is really just misbegotten. And I can, you know, I know many, many writers to whom that's happened. And there's no sense in duplicating that part of the old model.
Yeah. We are coming toward the end of our time. I wonder if you have any last words or advice for the writers who are listening.
Well, I don't have anything unique to say to the writers. I think that the writers who are listening to this probably have heard this before, but you need to treat your writing as if it mattered, as if it were important. It's not a question of being egomaniacal and thinking that there's something uniquely special about yourself, but there is something uniquely special about putting the words down. And in order to give that the importance that it deserves, you need to be faithful to it and go to your desk every single day. You could take Sunday off or Saturday, depending. And make that as inviolable as any other sacred commitment. And I think that your writing will ultimately show that commitment.
Thank you so much, Scott, for being here. And it's been a delight.
Well, thank you, Barbara. It's really great to talk to you again.
That was Scott Spencer. We were talking about An Ocean Without a Shore. Come back next week. We will be here with another wonderful author. Thank you for listening. By Travis Barrett. We're going to close out with more of his music. You can find him on Spotify. Thanks for listening. Seven lungs for breathing softly. What do we say?
once again. More permanent than the couch you kept clear for a friend. When are you moving out so I can sleep in your bed? No need to pretend that we brought separate air mattresses. Walls are full of watercolors, you painted for me. Of all the things that I'm scared of, you scare me the least. When are we moving in so we can share the same bed? Flowers, and we'll take pictures of them when they're dead. And we'll live while this world crashes down. Oh, we'll live. No one else can do that for us. Fields are full, so let's throw all our shit in the lake. 5 billion years, but the last 100 were a mistake. When are we moving on? I hear Mars looks great in the spring. Save us all, Elon. Our souls can thaw while we freeze.